Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. And I'm going to start with an article from AARP, the magazine. And this one is The Day Motherhood Changed, 40 years after America's first test tube baby was born. She looks back at the moment that sparked a revolution in fertility. I own a sterling silver necklace with a heart-shaped pendant engraved with the number 1. I wear it only on special occasions or when I speak at fertility conferences. The necklace was a childhood gift from two pioneering fertility doctors, and it's a reminder that I am a kind of accidental expert on reproductive technologies, although my birth was anything but an accident. 40 years ago, this past December 28th, I became the first baby born in the U.S. via in vitro fertilization, IVF. The event, which occurred at a hospital in Norfolk, Virginia, called for a packed house delivery room, complete with a PBS documentary film crew. Security guards blocked the doors to any potential intruders. On the street outside, protesters picketed against IVF, which was legal in Virginia but illegal in my parents' home state of Massachusetts. Near the protesters, TV news crews waited for word on whether I had come out normal. After a successful delivery, my mother and I were declared perfectly healthy. Howard Jones, M.D., who with his wife Georgiana Jones, M.D., had founded the fertility clinic where I was conceived, told the press, "I think this is a day of hope." For my parents, my birth was the fulfillment of a dream. For the United States, it signaled new possibilities for infertile couples and a radical shift in our understanding of when and how it was possible to become a mother. In a way, IVF helped redefine the careers and family expectations of every woman in the boomer generation and younger, whether or not they ever sought fertility treatments themselves. How it began. The first so-called test tube baby in the world, Louise Brown, was born in 1978 in the UK, though much of the scientific groundwork for her birth had been laid in the US. In 1944, two scientists at the Free Hospital for Women in Brookline, Massachusetts, were the first to successfully fertilize a human egg with sperm in vitro, that is, in a glass laboratory dish. But they soon ended their experiments. In 1965, while my future doctors, Howard and Georgiana Jones, were practicing at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, they mentored a visiting British researcher as he repeated the feat. In 1973, a Columbia University physician took the next logical step. He created and then incubated a couple's fertilized egg, planning to implant it into the woman's uterus 4 days later. If he had succeeded, it would have been the first IVF pregnancy in the world. But when a hospital administrator got wind of the doctor's project and feared controversy, he destroyed the incubating egg and the physician resigned under pressure. Research on IVF stalled in the U.S., and that British visitor who had worked with the Joneses in Baltimore, Robert Edwards, became part of the U.K. team that brought Louise Brown into the world. Why did America IVF research fall behind? Public pressure and fear. Some critics questioned the ethics of creating and destroying human embryos. Others worried about the health of any children created by the technique, predicting they could have serious deformities. And some objected on religious grounds, claiming that, in the words of Moral Majority Leader Daryl Falwell Sr., researchers were delving into an area that is far too sacred for human beings to be involved in. After the failed Columbia University IVF attempt in 1973, the federal government instituted a freeze on funding for IVF research. But after Brown's birth and the UK demonstrated just how normal a test tube baby could be, the resistance in the US began to drop away. In 1980, the Joneses, who had reached Johns Hopkins' mandatory retirement age of 65, opened the country's first IVF clinic in Norfolk. As Dr. Howard once told the Washington Post, "We thought it was an alternative to fading away. Within a year, my mother had become one of her first patients." My parents, this is her family story now, my parents, Judith and Roger Carr, both came from close families. Married young, they started trying for a baby as soon as my mom graduated from college with her teaching degree. But Judith, now 68, experienced three ectopic pregnancies. The fertilized eggs grew outside her uterus, leading to miscarriages and damage to her fallopian tubes that left her unable to conceive naturally. My devastated parents first learned about IVF from my mother's primary care physician. "The doctor said he didn't understand much about it," my mother recalls. "Although I had no idea how complex the process would be, Roger and I were willing to explore the possibility. As one of the first 50 couples admitted to the Joneses' new clinic at the Eastern Virginia Medical School, my parents commuted via airplane for hormone treatments, the harvesting and fertilization of the egg that would become me, and prenatal checkups. The fee at the time, not covered by insurance, was not insignificant for a young couple, up to $4,850 in lab fees and doctor fees for each attempt. But at age 28, Mom, and 30, Dad, my parents made history as the parents of the first IVF baby born in the U.S. I realized at a very young age that my birth was monumentous. I was the only kid in my class who had been on the cover of Life magazine and the subject of a Nova documentary. The Joneses helped me memorize a two-sentence explainer of my origins for anyone who asked. The sperm and the egg were combined and fertilized in a petri dish. Once the egg was fertilized, it was put back in the womb, and 9 months later I was born, just like every other baby. I remember Dr. Georgiana once telling me, "Your parents wanted you so very much, they just needed a little help from science." Now, due to the length of this article, I'm going to skip to the last section, which is where we go from here. Fertility technologies continue to develop. Some of the latest include ovary and uterus transplants, screening for inherited diseases before implantation, and the injection of a sperm directly into an egg if the man's sperm isn't able to penetrate an egg naturally. The version of IVF that brought me into the world seems primitive by today's standards, but what I have learned over the years of speaking with those going through fertility treatments is that people's hopes and dreams for their own education and careers, as well as for their families, are resilient and inspiring. While my Silver One necklace has a personal meaning to me and my parents, it has also become a reminder to me of all the people I've met because of my unique birth, including those struggling to create a family and those who have succeeded, whether the old-fashioned way through fertility treatments or through adoption. As a mother myself, I know that no matter how much our society or our technology changes, some things about becoming a parent will always remain the same. When we finally had you, we had such a feeling of relief that the process was over, my mother told me recently, and joy, so much joy. Elizabeth J. Carr is a patient advocate in Swansea, New Hampshire, and is a frequent speaker at infertility conferences worldwide. Now we're going to return to the Centennial Living Complete Guide to Heart Health for folks over 50. We have kind of veered away from this for the last couple of times, but let's get back to it now. And the section we're up to is five top heart-healthy supplements. And we may not do all of them today, but let's get started. Ideally, your heart health is built on a foundation of good habits, nutrition, exercise, restful sleep, and stress management. But sometimes even the most chilled-out vegan marathoner could use a boost. That's where supplements come in. to replace deficiencies or to support healthier levels of cholesterol, blood sugar, inflammation, and blood pressure, explains Joel Kahn, MD, an integrative cardiologist based in Bingham Farms, Michigan, and the founder of the Kahn Center for Cardiac Longevity. Before you plundle the supplement aisle, you know this. Supplements require a bit of research. In the U.S., they're regulated as food, not as drugs, by the Food and Drug Administration, which is responsible for giving the green light to pharmaceuticals. But that doesn't mean they're not powerful. That's why it's best to evaluate supplements for your personal heart health scenario, not based on what your best friend suggests. And because some doctors lack knowledge about supplements, it pays to do your own digging so you can make informed decisions. Even when it comes to vitamins and minerals, your blood work, rather than guesswork, is the best way to determine what you need. So talk to your doctor. She'll look for primary deficiencies, you're not getting enough of a vitamin or mineral, and secondary deficiencies, where you're getting enough, but the body isn't absorbing it properly for some reason. Let's take the trendy and important vitamin D. Your doctor might order a blood test if you're over age 50 or have osteoporosis or have had gastric bypass surgery, among other reasons. The blood work can show if you have a deficiency of the crucial vitamin, which can be treated with supplements or nutritional changes. You've heard the phrase, go big or go home. But this philosophy is not useful with supplements, where there is no need to megadose. More is not better. In fact, overly high doses of some vitamins and minerals can be harmful or even toxic, while others are just excreted in the urine. The Canadian Medical Association Journal reports that magnesium can cause diarrhea at doses above 750 milligrams a day, for example, and taking more than 0.91 milligrams a day of selenium can cause brittle hair and nails. The good news is that many nutrient deficiencies can be fixed with food choices, says Kahn. Foods high in vitamin D include wild mushrooms, salmon, and egg yolks, while ground flaxseed can elevate omega-3 fatty acid levels. Zinc, selenium, magnesium, CoQ10, B12, and folate are other common nutrients important for heart health that can be easily measured via a blood test. If testing is not available and you want to address any potential deficiencies, Kale suggests taking a broad-based multivitamin most days of the week. The following supplements contain heart-healthy compounds that you usually won't get in a standard multivitamin. Let's take a look. Red yeast rice, RYR, used in China for centuries both as a food and a medicine. RYR is the cooked rice that has been fermented with a type of mold, Monascus purpureus, which turns the grains their namesake color. Some RYR products contain yeast-produced compounds called monocolins, especially monocolin K, which is effective in lowering cholesterol. Merck used a fungus-derived compound similar to monocolin K to create lovastatin, which became the first statin drug in 1987. It is prescribed under the brand name Mevacor. A large, oft-cited 2008 study published in the American Journal of Cardiologists found that for people who had already suffered a heart attack, RYR extract, two daily 300 milligram doses, reduced the risk of another heart attack by 45% and reduced the need for additional treatments like bypass surgeries and angioplasties. A new study appearing in the 2021 Journal of the American College of Cardiology determined that RYR can be considered an effective and relatively safe lipid-lowering nutraceutical in healthy subjects with mild, hypercholesterolemia. It recommends consumers look for citrinin-free certified red yeast rice. Citrinin is a contaminant containing 3 to 10 milligrams of monacolin K. You probably won't find this information on labels, though, due to FDA rules, so you may have to use trial and error to see what works. Next, we have phytosterols, also known as plant sterols or plant stanols. Phytosterols are compounds found naturally in plant cell membranes. They are present in foods like nuts, seeds, and legumes, and may help block the body's absorption of cholesterol. They can also be found in pill or tablet form as supplements and added to some margarine spreads, such as Benecol and Smart Balance HeartRite. Supplementation may be useful for certain patient populations, says Eric Brandt, MD, a clinical researcher in the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine at the University of Michigan Medical School in Ann Arbor. This might include people who are dealing with stubbornly high cholesterol, who may combine plant sterols and stanols in combination with statins, or people who can't take statins due to the side effects. A review in the journal Atherosclerosis notes that at a dosage of 2 grams a day, plant sterols, stanols, can significantly inhibit cholesterol absorption and lower LDL-C levels by between 8 and 10%. However, other studies suggest that supplemental plant sterols lower cholesterol but may raise overall risk of heart disease. So talk with your doctor about what's best for your situation. And that is spelled phytosterols. Next comes berberine. This compound, an alkaloid, is found in hundreds of plant species belonging to that family, including golden seal and barberry. According to the Journal of Metabolism, berberine, that's B-E-R-B-E-R-I-N-E, is the main active component of the herb Coppice chinensis, French, which has historically been used in Chinese medicine. A meta-analysis of published in the Journal of Ethnopharmacology found berberine may have therapeutic effects for the heart, including lowering blood pressure and treating hyperlipidemia. Many of the studies on berberine have used a dose of 500 milligrams 3 times a day. It's available in capsules and soft gels. And a cautionary note, always let your doctor know what supplements you're taking. Now, there are two more and a sidebar in this article, and we will get to that next time. Now, let's also go back to prevention, finding your calm. And a couple of weeks ago, we were looking at how to use the power of positivity, the many different ways you can do that. So let's look at understanding that you're in charge of your emotions. Maybe you're someone who's reading this because you know you have a tendency to be a little negative. We've all been there. FYI, it's not just the way you are. The fact that you focus on how things are going wrong more than others do is partly due to the behaviors you saw modeled growing up and your personal experiences. But trying to be a more optimistic person can start with the simple decision to, well, be a more optimistic person. Our emotions are not just something that happened to us. We can actively change our emotions. We get to decide how we're going to feel, how you react to a particular situation, how you approach the situation, and how quickly you bounce back from the situation are all things that you can control. Another suggestion, write a letter of gratitude. This takes being thankful to the next level. There are definitely those ride or die people in your life who you may not ever have told how grateful you are for them. Let them know how much they mean to you by writing them a grateful letter, describing all the ways they've impacted you. They guarantee this will give both you and the other person a better outlook on life. Exercise, eat right, and get enough sleep. Easier said than done. These three are all those things your mother said, and turns out Mom was right all along. Fulfilling these basic needs will help you be less vulnerable to negative feelings. Granted, you may not feel motivated to go on a run or snack on an apple instead of a cookie all day, every day, but the more you do, the likelier you'll be able to generate positivity. Get out into nature. As much as spending the weekend bringing Netflix sounds like a great idea, taking a moment outside will do wonders for your mood. A 2019 study from the UK published in Scientific Reports found that spending at least 2 hours a week outside helps boost both your physical and mental health. Don't feel that you have to spend those 2 hours on a strenuous hike, though. Thompson says that even an easy walk in the park will do the trick. And while you're at it, you can work on your walking meditation practices that we've already talked about. Do something for someone else. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the treat-yourself mentality, but if you want to feel happier longer, it might also be worthwhile to adopt a treat-others mentality. Feeling that you're contributing to society or being of service to others has been shown to give individuals a longer-lasting hit of dopamine than doing something just for yourself. So, the next time you're at your favorite coffee shop, treating yourself to a chai latte, maybe consider treating the person standing behind you in line as well. Remember that it's a journey. Becoming a positive person doesn't just happen overnight. You are trying to rewire your brain's natural instincts, after all, and as long as you consistently work at having a more positive outlook, your mind will eventually follow. You're truly training your brain. You're training your brain to do something different than what it even wants to do. And that journey alone is worth feeling good about. And finally, have an encouraging mantra ready. It can also help to be your own cheerleader when you do experience setback. Think Jerry's Matt talk from Cheer. Thompson suggests telling yourself things like, you can do this. You'll get through this. You're doing your best. And you've got this to help get you through those tough times. Now, looking at AARP, the bulletin, this article, Battling for Safer, Fairer Nursing Homes. AARP Foundation legal team has long pushed for reform in a challenged industry. What America discovered during the COVID-19 pandemic, AARP's foundation's legal team has known for years. Some nursing homes and long-term care facilities can be dangerous places for residents. The legal team has been fighting a years-long battle to use the courts to address health and safety problems within the industry. This year has been particularly busy. In January, AARP Foundation attorneys sued federal agencies overseeing nursing homes, charging that removing the threat of a daily fine for unsafe practices just before the pandemic hit may have made the death toll worse. Then in April, the team won a judgment in California on behalf of Gloria Single, a nursing home resident who was barred from re-entering after a stay in the hospital. It was a long-running case to defend residents from being dumped without proper cause. It's important for AARP Foundation to be involved in these issues in the courts because all too often the victims here can be pretty invisible. There isn't really adequate oversight for nursing facilities. Here are some of the other legal battles the foundation is waging on behalf of nursing home residents. Levine versus Ventura Convalescent Hospital. This lawsuit was aimed at protecting nursing home residents from being given dangerous antipsychotic drugs without their informed consent or that of their families. California's Ventura County Superior Court granted final approval for a settlement for compensatory and injunctive relief on behalf of hundreds of nursing facility residents. Then we have Brown versus the District of Columbia. AARP Foundation attorneys brought this suit to force D.C. to create a system to help older adults get care without having to live in an institutional setting. After years of legal wrangling, the case is set to go to a retrial later this year. Fair Housing Justice Center versus New York. Foundation lawyers are involved in a legal challenge against the state and some care facilities on behalf of people on Medicaid in New York's assisted living program who use wheelchairs. The attorneys won a preliminary injunction on behalf of a woman who had to leave her assisted living facility because she needed a wheelchair during rehabilitation. The New York State Office of the Attorney General did not return calls for comments. A lawyer for the care facility defendants says this suit should be directed only at state regulators. Now, the cover story for this particular issue is one we're going to work on for some time. It's 99 great ways to save. So far we've gotten through number 6. Let's go to 7. Go deep on grocery flyers. Focused most on the front and back pages where supermarkets often put loss leaders, discounts that they actually lose money on to entice you into the store. Now for travel, buy a lifetime park pass. There are 63 official national parks in the U.S., but the National Park Service oversees 423 sites, including many that are far less visited than big name parks. A lifetime park pass, $80 for those over 62, gets you into all of them. Book flights on Sundays. A study by the Airlines Reporting Corporation last November showed that this was the day to get the lowest fares. A separate study by Expedia showed the best days to fly cheap were Thursdays and Fridays, the best days to fly cheap. Fly from hubs. Airlines use hub airports to consolidate planes and save costs. Fares are cheaper and stopovers rare when you fly between hubs. It might make sense to drive to a hub. Set up air travel alerts. Besides helping you find the lowest flight fares, websites like Skyrunner, Kayak, or Airfare Watchdog will notify you when destinations reopen to travelers and alert you to entry restrictions and quarantine requirements. Well, folks, we've run out of time again for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.